So if you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn to the book of Philippians, chapter 1. So last week, we took a break. We've been in the series on the book of Philippians ever since we started whatever this is. And so last week, though, was Easter. And I don't know if you could tell, but it's maybe there were those of you who were like, you got all the way to the end of the day, and you're like, wait a minute, was today Easter? Because that's been happening, I think, to those of us who are, like, every day has like sort of this Groundhog Day feel to it. But last week was Easter, and so we took a break from the Philippians series to kind of interact with ideas about exile and resurrection. And so now we're going back into the Philippians series, and that's what we're going to be talking about in a few minutes. So when this whole thing got started about 5 weeks ago, I remember, and of course, like, nobody really knew what this was going to be or how long it was going to be. Initially, I think the original thought was like 2 or 3 weeks. Like, I think that was the original message we were given. And so, and of course, there were other folks who were like, there's no way it's going to take longer. But I think the general conventional assumption was that this would take 2 or 3 weeks to sort of get figured out. Obviously, that's not what happened. But when the whole thing started, one of the conversations I found myself in quite a bit, just in text message form or on a couple of different podcasts I ended up being on over the last couple of weeks, one of the questions was like, okay, if you're going to be stuck in your house for however long this is going to be, do you have any goals? Do you have things that maybe you would hope to accomplish in that amount of time? And my first thing was like, I have a whole stack of books that I've been dying to read. And so I don't know why, by the way, I don't know why I thought being in my house with everybody else who also lives in my house the whole time was gonna give me more opportunities to read. I totally just forgot the fact that anytime I wanna get real reading done, I have to like go and buy a cup of coffee somewhere and then go to my local library and sit. Like, and which is not a thing I can do right now. So I'm currently in the place that I have to normally leave in order to get reading done. But for some reason I was like, I have a whole stack of books and I'll just read them in the next couple of weeks. That didn't happen. I have finished one book in this last couple of weeks. So, you know, I'll pat myself on the back for that, I guess. But I know a lot of people sort of entered into this with a sense of, okay, I've got some things I want to try. I've got some things I would like to accomplish. Like maybe painting rooms in your houses or, I don't know. I know there are several folks that I follow who said that they were going to use this time to try and learn another language. My brain is not functioning at the level that it takes to learn another language right now, but good on anybody who attempted to do that. I know there are other people who are like, I'm going to learn how to cook. I'm going to be a really, really good chef by the time this is all over. And then maybe you followed through on that, or maybe it's like boxed mac and cheese once a day for as long as it takes. Like maybe that's okay too. Maybe you're like me and you had like a reading list or like a list of sort of things you feel like maybe have gotten bottlenecked, and maybe this was the time that you were going to get it all caught up on. I don't know. I mean, and I know lots of folks had sort of this idea that we're going to use this time productively. And obviously that wasn't as simple as it maybe sounded for a lot of us for any number of reasons. For me, one of the goals that I set out to do, and I mean, there are a lot of things I set out to do, like the reading list, that were not going to happen. Excuse me. But the one thing I set out to do was I decided I want to at least one time a day sit down with our 3-year-old and read him one book. And so far, that's, I mean, it hasn't been every day, but it's been a lot more than it was before this. And the reason for that was was because, I mean, if you have multiple kids, you know, like some kids in some stages of life require more time and attention, like driving to places and helping with homework and doing all the activity types of things. And quite frankly, the one that has the least of those responsibilities ends up getting the least amount of time, like one-on-one time. And so that in our house, that was the 3-year-old. And so I decided like, okay, during this time, I'm going to read at least one book a day to the 3-year-old and sort of like reappropriate some of the time that sometimes is devoted to, again, like driving people places and all the things that parents end up having to do quite often. So, but anyway, I think there's been this weird tension that we've all sort of had to live in, which is, should I or should I not try to be productive during this time? Because on the one hand, this time is quite difficult because like not only are we all sort of like in the same place, I mean, you know, barring any sort of like emergency trips to the grocery store or if you're still going to work or like various like reasons to leave the house and then come right back, but for the most part, like we're in this place where there's a lot of anxiety around this time. Like maybe you have job anxiety, maybe you have anxiety about the virus itself, maybe you have anxiety about just all the things that you're not getting done because you created this list and now you're feeling guilty because it's 5 weeks later and the list is pretty much incomplete. And so maybe you're sort of like living inside of this weird tension of productivity, because again, on the one hand, this time is difficult and we can give ourselves a break, I think, when we can't get everything done or when we don't achieve our goals. This is a hard lesson for me. I tend to be most comfortable and at peace when I feel like I have a job to do, when I feel like there are tasks in front of me that I can perform. And this time has sort of like messed with my orientation towards that impulse, because again, we're in a weird time. There's a lot of anxiety, and like, should you really feel bad about the fact that you haven't learned Spanish yet in the 5 weeks that you've been in your house or whatever that might look like? So on the one hand, we should probably give ourselves a break, but on the other hand, we do sort of have this intuitive sense that we are still alive and we are capable of certain amounts of growth and forward motion and progress, even though everything sort of feels in stasis right now. We don't have to like fully go into like, everybody sit still and we'll just like, we'll hit the pause button on everybody's life. And then when this whole thing is over, we'll just unpause the whole thing and go right back to it. Like, I think we all have this sense that, no, these are days. This is time that we've been given in our lives. And the situation is obviously nowhere near ideal, but we also have this notion of like, yeah, but this is part of my life. Like this is going to be a season of my life that I will have had to sort of make some decisions in. And so we have this weird tension of like, there are some times where it's like, we just have to make it to the end of the day. We have to get to tomorrow. But then there are other times where it's like, yeah, but I'm still alive and I'm still kind of in the game, as it were. Like my existence has not been put on pause. So we have to sort of live inside the tension between these two kind of impulses. And because we're in a moment of waiting and anxiety and trauma, and we have to do whatever we can just to make it to tomorrow, and we're still alive. And these days can be received with some amount of hope and gratitude and awareness. So that brings us to the book of Philippians. So in the book of Philippians, by the way, if you're on our website, on our homepage, you can scroll down below all the announcement stuff, and the passages that we're gonna be looking at are below the feed. So you can take a look at that. If not, you can go to BibleGateway.com. We're using the NIV version. So anyway, that's what we're gonna be doing. But anyway, so Paul is writing this letter, and this is something we've covered every single time we've done this, but Paul is writing this letter. He's writing from a Roman prison. It's possible that the prison is in Rome. It's possible also that he's in prison in the city of Ephesus under Roman rule. Either way, he's in jail because Caesar wants him in jail, because he's an enemy of Caesar. So Paul is living in this sort of isolated, not ideal situation, and he's writing a letter to this other group of people who live in this Roman province called Philippi. And they're also kind of dealing with a lot of tension because they're helping Paul, who's an enemy of Caesar. And if you live in a Roman province, by the way, which we talked about a couple of times already, the city of Philippi loves the Roman Empire. In fact, there are retired military officers from Rome who have been relocated to Philippi as a reward for their faithful service to Caesar. So the atmosphere in the city of Philippi is very pro-Rome and pro-Caesar. And so you have this group of people who are writing to an enemy of Caesar, which could very easily get them labeled as enemies of Caesar. And if you're in the Roman Empire and you're labeled an enemy of Caesar, you don't get to live for much longer. So that's the situation. So you have Paul writing this letter to this group of people, and Paul is in a difficult, dangerous situation, and the group of people he's writing to are also in a difficult, dangerous situation. They're surrounded, but they're also kind of alone. So he kind of enters into the whole thing. He starts with grace and peace, and then he talks about there's a good work that's being done, and you are part of the good work. And then he goes out of that and into sort of this notion of, I really just miss you guys. I wish we could be together. I long for you. Like, there's this very beautiful pastoral notion that Paul has, like a genuine human desire to be back together with this group of people, which is very relatable to us right now. So he's gone through all of these, and then in verse 9, he kind of transitions and he says, okay, I do miss you guys. And so here, when I pray for you, here is how I pray. So now we're getting a window into like, how does Paul pray when he prays for this group of people? So this, we're starting in verse 9. And so Paul says, and this is my prayer, that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and depth of insight, so that you may be able to discern what is best and may be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God. So this sounds, there's a lot of big churchy kinds of language in this translation. And so it sounds like not a very relatable idea to us. Like, again, because he's using a lot of what sound like Bible-y kinds of words. But he's saying, when I pray for you, here are the things that I hope for you. Here are the ways that I hope you're doing. But basically the question becomes like, okay, what does all this mean? When Paul prays for this group of people in this situation, how does he pray and what is he looking for? What are the things that he is hoping to see in this group of people, or hear about at least from this group of people? So in verse 9, he says, this is my prayer, that your love may abound. So he starts off with this prayer, and the prayer begins with, I hope that you are a people of love, that you are showing love, that you are offering and exhibiting love to other people. But it's not just that they would have love, that their love would abound. Okay. Yep, that's why I... that was bound to happen. That was definitely going to happen at some point. I just didn't know it was going to happen right now. Do I reset it or do I just let it go?
That's fine. Just put it. Let's see.
Just like that. Well, it's a weird tripod situation. This is my nightmare. there we go. There. Caroline's over here fixing the thing. So now you know Caroline is here. And now you know that this is not very sturdy. What were we talking about? Love abound? Okay, yeah, that's where we were. So Paul's prayer here is, sorry. So Paul's prayer is that they would have some amount of love, but that that love would abound, which is definitely what I tried to write right there. So the word abound in Greek is the word parisos. And parisos in Greek literally means limitless increase or growth. So it's not just may you have love for other people and may your love be very strong. He's saying may your love be ever increasing. May you wake up every single day with a stronger capacity for love than you had the day before. So there's this, so again, it's not just love. It's like may you realize that your capacity for love is limitless. There is this ever-growing, ever-expanding thing inside of you that says maybe your capacity for love is a lot bigger than you thought it was. So that's the whole, what he's sort of saying here. When he's connecting love, when he says, I hope that your love will abound, he's saying like, I hope you never stop learning new things about what it means to be a person who loves others. So there's that, and then let's see how this goes. In knowledge, good. It's very sturdy. So he says, may your love abound in knowledge. So this is an interesting kind of connection of two different words here, because the word knowledge here is the word epignosis. And literally, it's not a knowledge that means like formulaic, like an understanding, like I've read a lot of books about love, so now I have this knowledge of what it means to be a person of love. So knowledge isn't just a thing that you carry around inside of your head, just in case you like end up in a trivia game or something like that, or you can pass some sort of test. Knowledge in the Greek here, in pair with epignosis, is knowing because you've experienced something. It is a knowledge that comes through a tactile interaction with reality. So again, it's not mechanical, it's not formulaic, it's not academic. This is knowledge that comes from participation in something. And it's knowing something because you have experienced that thing. I mean, what we're seeing right now, like this is such an easy sort of comparison here, but this is the difference between knowing about the fact that people right now are being laid off in like large numbers all across the country, all across the world, people are losing their jobs. So it's one thing for me to read an article in a publication and have it say, you know, unemployment is going up and people are being laid off. It's one thing for me to read that. It's another thing for me to lose my job. It's another thing for me to actually have someone that I care about who has lost their job, and now there is a financial strain that wasn't there before. So one is just like the academic sort of understanding of like, yeah, that's a thing that happens. But then the other, epignosis, is no, I've seen this thing. I know how this works. And I know that there is an experiential dimension to this whole thing. So he says, he's talking about knowledge, but he's not just talking about like a head understanding. He's saying, may you have some amount of experience that informs the way you see the world and that informs the way that you show love to others. So Paul is saying, May your knowledge come from a place of profound experience. May your life experiences give you more capacity for love. So, and then he says, may your love abound in knowledge and in depth of insight. I'm not writing that down because that's definitely going to knock it down if I go any lower. So just know I was going to write the phrase depth of insight, but decided against it just right now. So depth of insight is the word aesthesis. And aesthesis, depth of insight, is when you are keenly aware of your own, of the consequences of your own actions. So this is about, it's not just about knowledge, it's about wisdom. So we could have a whole conversation about what's the difference between wisdom and knowledge. Knowledge is sort of an understanding of something. Wisdom is like the ability to know what to do with the knowledge that you have. So he's pairing these two ideas together. So depth of insight is, I am aware that when I make choices, it affects other people. And so I have to be cautious and wise as it pertains to my own choices. So he's saying there are consequences to your actions. And this is, again, it's about wisdom. It's knowing that the choices that you make will affect the lives of other people. I mean, that's been one of the biggest things about this, right? Is that the social distancing and the flattening the curve, it's not just because I don't want to get sick, which I don't, but that's one part of it. Another part of it is the knowledge of, if I become a carrier of this virus and I interact with somebody who is more vulnerable to the worst effects of it, then I could actually have a possibly lethal interaction with somebody that I care about. So depth of insight right now is like not putting myself at risk and not putting other people at risk. That is, it's not just like knowledge of the situation. It is the ability to have some sort of wisdom and depth of insight of like, oh, right, my actions could actually be very, very harmful to somebody else. And that's what Paul is talking about. He's obviously not talking about that exact scenario, but he's saying, please know that when you act, your choices matter. So Paul's prayer for this group of people, and we're just in verse 9, Paul's prayer for this group of people seems to center around love and knowledge and wisdom. So he starts, like basically the whole thing is, may your love increase. May your love abound. May you find that your love is, your capacity for love is limitless. And so he starts there, and then he says, but also may your knowledge flow out of your love. Because knowledge is a thing that can be abused, is it not? Because for Paul, knowledge should always be informed by love. Knowledge should always submit itself to love. Knowledge without love, for Paul, doesn't have a whole lot of value. In fact, take a look at 1 Corinthians 13. This is, if you've ever been to a wedding, if you can remember what it was like to go to weddings, there's a passage that gets read a lot at weddings, and it's 1 Corinthians 13. This is the love passage. And so in 1 Corinthians 13, Paul, same writer as Philippians, says this. He says, if I speak in the tongues of men or of the angels, but do not have love, I am a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. And he kind of goes on with that for a little while. So basically what he's saying here is like, yeah, knowledge doesn't get us very far if the knowledge is used as some sort of weapon or some sort of like just a vessel for like self-righteousness or moral superiority. Like if I use my knowledge to only make myself feel better and other people feel worse, then Paul is saying, then what's the point of the knowledge? If your knowledge is not informed by love, then what's the point of having the knowledge? So he's saying, may your knowledge flow, may your love continue to expand, but also may your love inform the things that you already sort of know about the world. So in fact, The number of people who have come to our church and have said some version of, yeah, I grew up in a church where we spent a lot of time going, or I grew up in a house where I spent a lot of time going to church and like memorizing Bible verses and being told over and over and over again how important it was that I believed in this thing and that I participate in the ways that I've been made to participate. And so you were told these things. You were given this, like, if you will, knowledge, like this cognitive awareness of things, but then also in that same system, you were modeled, like the things that were modeled for you were things like disdain for other people, a complete lack of grace or forgiveness towards others, a sort of like a judgmentalism towards everybody who isn't just like you. And so it is possible to be given lots and lots of information, but for that information to never intersect with the concept that the whole thing is supposed to be driven by love. And if love is not present in those spaces, it's like a clanging cymbal. It has no bearing in anything good that's being born in the world. Love needs to be the engine that drives the knowledge and the wisdom. So the prayer here, first of all, is may your love increase, and then may your knowledge flow out of your love, but then also may your knowing be knowing. May you have a tactile experience with this kind of love. May you understand grace and peace and love because you have received grace and peace and love. So that's just in verse 9. We haven't even touched verses 10 and 11. So let's go back to Philippians chapter 1, verse 10, where it says, actually, we'll go back to verse 9 because it kind of, 10 is starts in the middle of a sentence for some reason. So in Philippians chapter 1, verse 9, it says, and this is my prayer, that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and depth of insight, so that you may be able to discern what is best and may be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God. Again, big churchy kinds of language, but here's what he's getting at. So he uses this word discern, which, again, very churchy word, but this word discern, it literally comes from a first century term that was used for handling money. So what he's saying is, may you possess something, and may you know the value of the thing that you possess. When I was a kid, I grew up in a house where my dad was a banker. And so there would be some days where my brother and I would have to go after school. We'd go to the bank where my dad worked, and there was like this little break room with a VHS TV set. It's the thing, way that people used to watch movies, these like giant cumbersome plastic boxes with tape on the inside of them. Ask your grandparents about it. They'll tell you everything. So they had this VHS TV set in the break room, and my brother and I would sometimes just sit in there and watch videos. And sometimes we would be allowed to go rent a video at the movie rental place down the street. It's a small town. Or sometimes we weren't able to do that for whatever reason. And so we were left with whatever they had in the building to just sort of keep us occupied. And one of the things that they had plenty of were teller training videos. So I'm like 11, 12 years old, and I'm sitting in the break room of this bank, and my brother and I are watching multiple videos about how best to be a teller at a bank. And part of those instructional videos had to, I don't know, it's so weird like how this is like locked inside my brain. Like most, our kids watch Stranger Danger videos. My brother and I were like, let's watch that one about handling counterfeit dollar bills. So one of the things that we saw in these videos was like, yeah, there are all sorts of techniques to knowing the difference between a real dollar bill and a counterfeit or a fake dollar bill. And by the time I was 12, I could have told you what that was. Now, like, the currency looks different now, so I don't know if I could still do it. But there was a time where I knew a lot. As a 12-year-old, I probably knew more than most 12-year-olds about how to spot a counterfeit dollar. So the idea of being able to, and the idea of working as a teller or in some sort of institution where you handle a lot of cash, is sort of the ability to really quickly be able to know the difference between something that has value and something that does not have value. And so what Paul is doing, Paul is using this word, this discern, he's using this word to say, may you interact with your choices as if you naturally have this instinct for knowing the value of how you make your choices. So in other words, may you develop a natural instinct that will inform tells you what the next right thing to do is. May you just sort of have an eye for, yeah, if your love abounds, and your knowledge is informed by your love, and you have a certain amount of wisdom, then what's going to happen is you will begin to make choices that reflect that reality, that sort of inner sense that you carry around with you. So he's saying here, yeah, my hope is that you will become the kinds of people who just naturally interact with other people from a place of love and a place of wisdom, and that you will make choices that are good, not just for you, but for the people who are around you. So, it kind of goes back to this question of like, what is the next right thing for me to do? Like, are there things that I should be doing, or should I be making plans for like really far out, or should I just be sort of looking at my current situation and saying, okay, what's the next thing? What is the next thing I need to do? Because it's really hard to plan any further out. Am I the only one, by the way, who feels like any attempt to make any plans at all past the next 2 days, does that not feel a little bit overconfident at this point? You know what I mean? Like, the number of times we've been told like, okay, it's going to be this amount of time. And then we get to that point and it becomes like, no, actually we're going to have to like continue to push this back, and we're going to have to, you know, keep this kind of going for a little while longer. And so it becomes really hard to say like, well, here's what we're going to do in August, you know, because like we have no idea. So it can be really overwhelming to start thinking about like how far out this, like how far out we have to sort of continue to think about this and interact with this. And it can become very overwhelming. And that's part of, I think, one of the reasons why a lot of us go to a dark place, because we don't see anything beyond like the current kind of cycle that we're in. So I think that this is an interesting kind of turn of phrase that Paul uses, where he talks about depth of insight and the ability to discern, because what he's saying is maybe you don't have to know every single thing that's going to happen next. Maybe the best you can do is say, okay, what's the next right thing for me to do? I cannot plan beyond the next day or two, maybe even not even that far, but I can say, okay, it is 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning and I have to make one choice about what I will do with my time. What's the next right thing for me to do? And I think this whole situation, one of the things that this has taught us is that the best we can do most of the time is simply ask this question, what is the next right thing to do? Because that kind of right now is the only thing I have any power over. So the question then for each of us, and we're all sort of in our own, even though we're in a similar situation with the pandemic, we're all kind of in our own unique specific situations because we're all in different places and we're all dealing with different dynamics in terms of family and work and just all the other things that kind of swirl around this. And so the next right thing for me might not be, and probably is not, the same thing as whatever the next right thing for you would be. So maybe for you, the next right thing is to ask yourself, who do I need to call? We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but who do I need to call today? Who do I need to send a text message to or set up some sort of like FaceTime or Zoom hangout with this person? It's been a little while and I'm a little concerned that no one's checking in on them. So maybe the next right thing to do is to check in on somebody that you care about. Maybe the next right thing for you to do is to take a nap because you're not sleeping as well as you thought you would during this time. Because there's a lot of despair, there's a lot of anxiety, there's a lot of like waking up in the middle of the night and having 1,000 things running through your head that you can't slow down. And so that what ends up happening is your kids get up and then you're parenting for the rest of the day and you're exhausted. And so maybe the next right thing for you is to carve out some time so that you can take a nap or get some rest or go sit outside when the sun is shining and just sort of give your body permission to receive something that it probably really needs. So the next right thing for you might have to do with some amount of self-care. Maybe the next right thing to do is to turn off your phone. Because you're calling people and you're checking in on people, but also you're checking the news feed. And for a lot of us, myself included, the more time I spend reading about this, the more my anxiety peaks. And so I have to sort of live in this space of, like, I need to know enough to where I'm not just in the dark about all this stuff, but I need to not go all the way down into the rabbit hole where I'm living sort of in the worst case scenario all day, every day. So anyway, maybe the next right thing for you to do is turn off your phone. Maybe the next right thing for you to do is turn on your phone. It could be totally different depending on what's going on with you right now. Maybe it's eat something. Maybe it's eat something that won't make you feel sad and tired. Which, by the way, maybe it's like I need to reach for like the comfort food of all comfort foods. Last week, after our Easter service, for dinner last Easter, what we decided to do just to sort of like make an event out of it, like make us all feel like we were doing something special for Easter, we got Babe's Chicken to go. They're doing curbside right now. Keep Babe's Chicken open, whatever. Listen, we cannot lose Babe's Chicken. So I need us all to do our part if you're a chicken eating kind of person. So we got Babe's Chicken to go. We picked it up curbside and we brought it home. And before we ate the Babe's Chicken, anybody who's ever eaten out of Babe's Chicken will know this tradition. We danced the Hokey Pokey as a family. And my greatest regret so far of this entire pandemic is that we didn't film that. And it was sort of this like, yeah, the next right thing for us to do was eat something that isn't necessarily good for us, but it will create some memories. It will like go into our brains and kind of remind us like, oh yeah, there are these things that we do that we love and we still kind of in a way have access to. So, the next right thing for you to do may look different right now than it will tomorrow. So the question that Paul, I think, is raising is like, my prayer here is that you would be informed by love, that your knowledge and your wisdom would flow out of that love, and that you would be able to wisely answer the question, what's the next right thing for me to do? Because sometimes that's the best we can do. Most of the time right now, I think that's the best that we can do. So then the question becomes, okay, well, how am I supposed to know what the next right thing to do is? Is it just like whatever feels good? Is it whatever somebody else needs from me? Like, how do I even begin to even calculate that? Because even that can feel a little bit overwhelming. Take a look at the book of Galatians chapter 5. So Paul in Philippians, uses this kind of big phrase where he talks about like the fruit of righteousness. Like the whole, the sort of the end game of the whole prayer is that there would be some sort of fruit of righteousness. In other words, again, it's a churchy way of saying, my hope is that you will, like all of these things will increase for you in such a way to where like you are seeing good born into the world. Fruit of righteousness for Paul is these are the good results of the wise, loving choices that we make. In fact, in the book of Galatians, Paul uses the same basic concept again, the idea of fruit being the result of something that we're participating in. And this is a very famous passage. It's referred to often as the fruits of the Spirit. So in Galatians chapter 5, verse 22, Paul writes, "But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance." My translation says forbearance. Yours might say patience. Forbearance, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law. So when in doubt, when we're sitting here like, well, I don't know, what is the next right thing for me to do? Maybe go to this list and say like, I don't know, what is the thing that you can do that will bring more love or joy or kindness into the world? Because when in doubt, this is a pretty good like place to start. I don't know, but I do know that this one thing, dancing the hokey pokey, brought some joy into this house. And eating babe's chicken brought some joy into this house. So we opted for joy in that moment. And so maybe for you, that like joy is the fruit that you have seen the least in these days. So what would it look like for you to have some sense of joy or grace or some amount of kindness even? Like what would it look like for me to do something that would bring more kindness into this space that I'm currently occupying? So anyway, so when in doubt, do something that brings more of these things into the world. Because Paul seems to believe that even in their current situation, even in his jail situation, and they're kind of locked in the middle of this very dangerous town situation, in the middle of all this, in the middle of the current circumstances, Paul seems to believe that they can still become people who are more capable of love and grace and peace. Because even now, we can still become people who are more loving, more patient, more kind, more aware of how our words and our actions affect other people. Because, and going back to where we started with the to-do lists, Paul's prayer seems to not have that much to do with productivity. His prayer is not like, and I hope you'll go and like recruit more people to be a part of this thing. Or my prayer is that you'll, yell at your in-laws because they're not participating in the way that you want them to, or that you would go to your job and like say the things that I want you to say. Like, no. His prayer is not about productivity. His prayer is about what kinds of people are we becoming in these moments. Paul isn't saying, I hope you get all these things done while you're in these circumstances. He's saying, I hope that in the middle of this, you never stop being the kind of person who discovers new ways of showing love to others. My hope is that your knowledge would come from a place of experience and wisdom. And so his prayer has nothing to do with the to-do list, and it has nothing to do with all the things that they are or are not accomplishing. His prayer is, I really hope that you're becoming the kinds of people who are better at showing love than you were when this whole thing got started. It's who are we becoming? So the questions I think Paul leaves us here with are, is my love for other people, my capacity for love, is it expanding? Am I finding new and more profound and beautiful ways of becoming a more loving person in this world? Or is my knowledge informed by love for other people? Or is it just a clanging cymbal? Or what is the next right thing for me to do? So again, he's not asking about productivity. He's asking about like, who are you becoming? Who are we as a people becoming in the middle of this? Because these are still days that add up to our lives. We will this for a lot of us, maybe for all of us, this season that we're in right now, this will be one of the, if not the defining event of most of our lifetimes. It's becoming more and more apparent that that's the way this is right now. And so then the question becomes, okay, well, in the middle of that, did I become a more loving, a kinder, more joyful, more grace-oriented, more peace-oriented type of person, or did I not? And so the question Paul is raising here is, what kind of people are we becoming? What would it look like for us to become people who embody this ever-expanding notion of love and knowledge and wisdom and and discernment? What would it look like for us to continue to breathe more life into the world around us and to be bearers of love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and self-control? What would it look like for us to become those kinds of people, even in our current situation? Who are we becoming? That's the question. That's Paul's prayer. May you become the kinds of people you were always meant to be, even now. Let me pray for us. God, we thank you for this prayer from Paul. We pray that we would embody the spirit of this prayer, that we would become the kinds of people for whom love is ever increasing, that we would become the kinds of people who are able to show love and grace and kindness and peace towards others. And may this be our prayer for one another. May this be the way that we encourage one another, that may we as a people become more loving, more wise, more able to bring these beautiful gifts, the fruits of the Spirit, into the world, regardless of our current circumstances. May we remain healthy and safe in the middle of this very difficult time. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.